Hello, friends. Welcome to This Day in Jack Benny. I'm John Henderson, and I've got a special guest today, Jim Benny. No relation to Jack Benny.
Oh, no. We spell it correctly. I-E on the end. Although my uncle was named Jack.
Really?
And because of the difficulty that ensued having that particular name, he used to go by John all the time.
So you are the curator of a blog called trowelfaz.blogspot.ca. Tell me about that blog and how you got it started.
Well, it's kind of hard to say. It's based more or less on it's a cartoon blog is what it was designed to do with pictures of various animated cartoons from the Golden Age. But because I've been in the radio business for over 40 years, I have a bit of an interest in radio history as well. So I put on various stories about old radio shows and, in some cases, old television shows and people who were involved with them. And because Sunday is well known, certainly in the radio business, as Jack Benny's Day on the radio, I try to post every Sunday an old newspaper story or some commentary about the Benny radio or television shows.
Very cool. So when did you first hear old-time radio?
Oh, Lord. It has to go back when I was a kid, which doesn't go back to the original days.
Yeah.
But there was a radio station here locally that used to play old-time radio in the 1960s. And I used to listen to it every night. And I enjoyed the comedy and variety shows far more than the mystery or detective shows or the kids shows like Jack Armstrong and that sort of thing. I just gravitated toward the funnier shows. And out of the works that they used to play on the radio, the sitcoms didn't really grab my attention too much, but I liked the variety shows. And that's more or less where Benny started. And he kind of evolved as time wore on into more of a sitcom format.
Yeah, definitely. It's interesting. I was just listening to an episode, and it's kind of in the middle there, where he's not doing a straight variety show, and he's not quite a sitcom yet. It's kind of like he's on location, and then it's like, oh, look, let's turn on the radio, a song by Kenny Baker.
Well, there, I think part of it had to do with two things. The war changed a lot of things, in that he was on the road an awful lot, and doing shows in front of servicemen, and he had to adapt his humor somewhat to of a more inside basis. And the other thing that happened was he changed writers, as you know, about the time that they changed sponsors from General Foods to American Tobacco. And the new writers were the ones that seemed to sit down and say, well, you know, we have to kind of freshen the format. The ratings are going down a little bit. And that's where they started to gravitate more to having Rochester on and doing more behind-the-scenes type plots, as opposed to the 1930s shows where you'd hear a takeoff on some movie in the second half of the broadcast.
Well, you may think that I'm a real expert on Jack Benny. I'm really more of a super fan, so I don't know all the ins and outs of behind the scenes and all of that. So speaking of the writers, you know, I've heard a few names tossed around, like Beloine and stuff, but I don't really know the writers. Do you know who the writers were and, you know, kind of the influence that they had?
Well, it's kind of hard to say. At the beginning, as you may know, Jack picked up a fellow by the name of Harry Kahn, who had worked with him off and on in the vaudeville days. And they had a falling out roughly about 1936, I believe it was. And then some temporary writers came on. And that's when, after about another half year, that's when he hired Bill Morrow and Ed Beloine. And they stayed with him until the war, when Morrow got drafted and Beloine went on to other things. Although he came back a couple of times to do his Mr. Billingsley character. So at that point, he had to hire a whole new set of writers, and he started with five. And after 3 weeks, Cy Howard, who was one of the five, decided he took off and became a producer on his own. So he was left with the usual group I think everybody associates with Jack Benny, Milt Josephsburg, and that group.
So, you know, when you're listening to the Jack Benny program, is there a particular, like, aspect or ongoing a gag or something like that that you really like a favorite?
Gee,
Like, for me, I laugh out loud every time he yells, now cut that out!
I think one of the things I really enjoy listening to, other than the Christmas programs, because I think everyone loves those, because there's so many characters that get involved, and everybody's there, and poor Jack gets picked on, and then Mel Blanc gets picked on a lot. the other thing I really like are the shows where he's tuning in a radio or a television broadcast of some kind. He's got Sarah Berner as the nasally singer, and or Bea Benaderet or Elvia Allman acting as some soap opera actors that just goes on and on and on and on. And he gets exasperated listening to the radio. I've always enjoyed that kind of, it's almost like an inside bit of humor from the radio industry from his standpoint.
Yeah. So then on the flip side, is there like a least favorite thing?
I'm not crazy about the year-end allegories that he does. I understand why he did them, and certainly during the war years, some very pertinent thoughts were put forward at the end of the broadcast. But for me, they just don't hold up. I've never really gotten to them that much. Mm-hmm. And of course, there are a lot of broadcasts that we simply have never heard. Transcriptions of the very earliest shows, other than the first broadcast, don't survive for almost a 3-year period. So we don't know what those shows actually sounded like. There are copies of scripts available, hidden away in archives, that mm-hmm. if someone wants to go to the extent of digging them out, they can read them. But we really don't know what those early ones sounded like.
Right. So, you know, speaking of the wartime era, it seems to me like, for the most part, Jack stayed away from, like, the politics and the war of current events, except for when it comes to, like, public service announcements. Would you say that's accurate?
I would say most comedians did roughly the same thing. They were more interested in bolstering the morale of the troops than to make any comment on either the war itself or the politicians behind it. I gather, although I wasn't around then, it was a much different time where that sort of thing simply, you know, everybody simply got behind the Allied effort as opposed to the kinds of things that happened when the Vietnam War came. And I think that's really when people started questioning whether America's involvement in wars was actually a good thing or not.
Yeah, I mean, he did go on location a number of times and do like stage stuff for the troops.
Well, he certainly did. And you can tell the audience really enjoyed having not only him there, but the biggest cheers I hear on these broadcasts from the war era is the time when Rochester came on. The soldiers just seemed to love him. And I think that's part of the reason that the Benny Show adapted in the later years, where they put more Rochester on the air. And Rochester wasn't a player, so he was at home somewhere tending to the house. So they had to go to the house a lot more to put him on the broadcast, and thus it became more of a situational comedy.
Mm-hmm, definitely. So let's talk about myths. The very first radio appearance of Jack Benny, as the story goes, I've heard Ed Sullivan say it himself, that it was on the Ed Sullivan radio program, but that's not true, is it?
No, and I think what happened, it was a combination of things. It was simply, after a number of years, Jack simply misremembered the fact that what the Sullivan Show did when he appeared on it was it launched him into his radio career, in that the people at Canada Dry's ad agency heard the broadcast and they tried to sign him up. But the earliest... how can I put this? If you look at early press clippings from 1933, 34, they don't say that Sullivan's Show was the first show. This was something that kind of mushroomed as the years rolled on. But he did do a broadcast in Los Angeles in the 1928, when he was appearing in one of the short films for MGM, and he did that as a publicity stunt. There's also an instance where in 1931 he appeared on a broadcast in Cleveland. And completely, because he was making a personal appearance in vaudeville, and they invited him to this radio station where he completely ad-libbed a half-hour broadcast with some host who really wasn't quite expecting what was going on, and they kind of played it by ear.
Yeah. So are there any other, like, myths about Jack Benny that people assume are true but that you know are probably not true?
Well, I guess the standard things that people think that his character on the radio was how he was in real life.
Right.
And Benny himself used to talk about getting nasty letters from people about how dare you treat Rochester that way. Well, Rochester, of course, you know, was a hugely wealthy man himself, had a stable of horses. He had a whole pile of antique cars. It wasn't like he was a poor downtrodden guy who was doing Jack Benny's washing in real life.
Yeah.
And it was the same thing that the people thought he actually owned a Maxwell, and people really thought he was cheap. And it seems like Jack got exasperated about that after a while, because he mentioned in a number of interviews in the 60s that he'd deliberately leave larger tips or whatever just to make sure people didn't realize that what they heard on the radio was the way he was.
Well, I heard a story about that, and a waitress gave the money back and said, "Please, Mr. Benny, don't spoil the illusion."
Yeah, that's right. And the other thing, it's hard to pick rumor from fact.
Yeah.
But it deals with how he met Mary Livingston. There are several different stories, which I think historians have tried to figure out a timeline to try to connect them all, and it doesn't seem to work quite properly. But I think it's generally accepted that he did meet Mary Livingston in Vancouver.
Really?
In 1921, and he did meet her again, likely at the May Company, sometime in the mid-20s.
Right. Mary Livingston is not her real name.
That's correct.
Her real name is Sadie Marks. And
is
it true that she's related to the Marks brothers?
Well, from what people have been able to determine, if there's a relationship, it's a very, very distant one.
Okay.
So I'll accept that maybe she's a third cousin or fourth cousin or something. But you read different reports about it, and I don't know how deeply some people have delved into it. The Internet's a problem because you read something online and you accept it as true, and then you broadcast it somewhere else, and then eventually you find out it's not quite accurate.
Yeah.
So the Internet goes around telling people that she was and she wasn't, so it's hard to really pick. I kind of take the middle ground. I've heard from one person who's looked into this and seems to be an expert on the situation, that, yeah, there's a relationship, but it's very distant.
All right, what about this famous story? When Jack Benny died, he left in his will that each day a rose would be delivered to Mary.
And apparently that's quite accurate, and it's mentioned in Mary's book, for one. I believe it's also mentioned in Milt Josephsburg's biography on Jack Benny.
Mm-hmm. So if somebody had never heard any old-time radio show and you were going to suggest Jack Benny, where would you have them start?
Oh, gee, that's a tough one, because as we've been talking about, his show did evolve over the years. And in the 50s, the danger is if you listen to a show that you kind of have to have been a long-time listener to pick up on some of the references.
Right.
If you hear Frank Nelson going, yes, everyone laughs simply because of the familiarity. If you're hearing it for the first time, you're kind of going, what's this?
Yeah.
So I really don't know. I would suggest probably somewhere in the later 40s, when most of the elements of the Benny show, for example, Mel Blanc being the train announcer, and the Si Sue routine that Jack did with Mel as the Mexican, when those started developing in the mid-40s, that may be the best place to start, because everyone's kind of learning at the same time that all these new characters are coming on board.
Mm-hmm. So what's your favorite era?
Well, that's tough to say, because I like many of the satires that they did on current movies in the 30s.
Mm-hmm.
But I like Don Wilson's Jell-O commercials.
Yeah.
Because Don always seemed like he really enjoyed eating this stuff.
Yeah.
And it's not the same when you get the Lucky Strike.
Yeah.
The whole approach was changed, where the comedy came out of the middle commercial, with a sportsman doing some parody song and Jack going, "Wait a minute,
yeah,
wait a
yeah.
minute," and then stopping him. But I can't really pick out a favorite era. I like the later shows, even going into toward the end in 1955. But I also like the earlier versions where they did a lot of plays. So there's a non-answer for you.
Yeah. Well, that makes me wonder if they added, like, the sportsman to spice up the commercials, given that, you know, his enthusiasm was not the same as it was for Jell-O. And I think Grape Nuts Flakes was even
well,
lower.
Yeah,
well,
Grape Nuts Flakes were kind of imposed on Jack and by his sponsor. They had tried, General Foods, that is, had tried a number of times through the agency Young and Rubicam to get Jack to switch off from Jell-O for whatever reason. This went back to the 30s, and they tried twice, and they couldn't move him. And then finally, the only reason it changed was the war came along, and there wasn't any Jell-O, or at least there wasn't enough of it that warranted a radio ad campaign, so they had to switch. But that particular period, just before Boulogne and Morrow left in the 1942-43, the ratings did go down, and you can tell listening to the shows that they've lost a bit of their snap. So I would agree that the sportsmen came in not only because they had been used in other situations off and on over the years, but they did add something to what could have been a very hard sell, advertising cigarettes.
Yeah. You recently wrote about Don Wilson feeling typecast. Tell me about that.
Well, I think everybody felt the same way. Don was the fat guy, and that's where they focused their jokes, and it was over and over and over and over again. And after a while, you kind of stagnate in the same situation year after year after year. You want to do something else. I think it's the same with any actor. You look at Purnell Roberts when he left Bonanza. It was the same sort of thing. He got tired of playing the same role, and he wanted to try something else. And I think that happened with Don Wilson. It happened with Sam Hearn when he was Schlepperman in the early 30s. Everybody thought of him as the one character, and he wanted to try something else. And audiences wouldn't accept him as that way. And I think Don went through the same thing. He thought, I can do more than just, you know, take fat guy jokes from somebody else. And he wanted to try something else.
Yeah, I was doing some research about an episode recently, and I was surprised to find out that Don Wilson had like a bit part in a Marilyn Monroe movie.
Yeah, his agent signed him for a couple of things. He'd done some work. I can't remember the studio. I want to say it was Paramount. But he was signed to a shorts contract in the mid-1937, 38, in there. And he was doing a few short films at the same time. But, yeah, he had a deal where he could write his own ticket when it came to movies, and he did a couple in the early 50s.
Yeah. Like, maybe it's just from hearing the show so often, but I almost had a hard time, you know, pulling him out of the box and imagining what else he could do. Even in Buck Benny Rides Again, he's in that movie for a couple seconds as an announcer, just basically speaking into a microphone. And in this movie, he had an actual part. He was like the husband of like a couple, a friendly couple, and he was just giggling and being friendly to the character. And it was a kind of a different side of him that I never even thought of.
Well, similarly, I think that's the reason that Jack wasn't so popular in movies. Everyone expected him to play his character. And if he didn't, it was, you know, the novelty eventually wore off of seeing him on the big screen, and his movies became less and less popular.
Mm-hmm.
I think he really suffered that he couldn't change his character either, because what he put on the radio was so ingrained in the minds of the audience that that's the only thing that they would accept.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned Schlepperman. What is the deal with Schlepperman and Mr. Kitzel? I know I started listening when I was quite young, and I didn't even realize they were like supposed to be a stereotype. They were just silly characters to me. So what was the mindset like, you know, back in the 30s and even the 40s?
Well, if I'd been around then, I'd be able to tell you.
Yeah.
I gather it was a holdover from vaudeville, where you had ethnic characters with accents doing comedy. And I suspect that's why, you know, Jack must have loved the Jewish dialect characters. So he had Schlepperman for a while. He had Patsy Flick doing one when Schlepperman disappeared for a couple of years. And then Artie Auerbach came on just shortly after the war.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed that the audience liked that kind of humor. They liked those particular characters. The same on Fred Allen's show, where, you know, Mrs. Nussbaum was very popular.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why he had them there. The characters got laughs, so he kept them on.
Yeah. I mean, you're a cartoon guy. You really enjoy cartoons. Mel Blanc, of course, is famous for his cartoons. How did Mel Blanc get involved in the Jack Benny show?
Well, it depends on whose story you want to go with. Mel had been doing some work for Al Pierce on his radio show. But originally, as Mel stated in his autobiography, he was doing the growling voice of Carmichael the polar bear, who was Jack's pet for about 4 years up until from 37 up until about the war. And slowly but surely, they had him do other parts. About 1942, 43, during the period we were talking about, there were things weren't exactly on the rails very well. He did a meek insurance salesman character for about a year. It didn't seem to work. Mel took it to other radio shows, but they still kept him on doing odds and ends, animal voices. He did his English horse, which he seemed to love doing. And then he did the impression of Al Jolson for a season, which as a running gag. And eventually, I guess that Mel and Jack Benny hit it off very well. I know that they hung out personally. And slowly but surely, Mel ended up doing more and more shows. And if you look toward the last, I'd say, three or four seasons, he was on almost every episode. Even though he wasn't listed in the actual cast of the show, he was their main supporting player.
Yeah. I mean, when you hear some of the things like the crazy sound effects and animal noises, all that, you know it's Mel Blanc, and you expect that.
And he's absolutely brilliant.
Yeah.
He's far more, everyone thinks of him as Bugs Bunny and all the Warner Brothers characters, but he got a chance to really, really let loose on the Benny show. And his acting is, if you sit there and listen to it and figure out, or try to figure out how he actually did it, It's amazing, just the abilities that he had. That people, I guess, they think, oh, I can make funny voices, but nobody could do Mel Blanc.
Yeah,
and including all the other people that worked in cartoons as well. There will never be another Mel Blanc. He was just brilliant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my favorite is the violin teacher.
Yeah,
he just feels desperate at the end of his rope, and it's perfect.
Well, something else to keep in mind as well, if you talk about Mel Blanc's talent, is you have to remember that he was also the voice of Pepe Le Pew. So he did a completely different French
right.
accent in those cartoons as he did as Professor LeBlanc.
Mm-hmm.
And you can granted, if you listen to enough Benny radio shows, you can hear a few characters that, yes, he did the same voices in cartoons. But there are other instances where he's using dialects which are completely different from what he did at Warner Brothers to what he did on radio.
Mm-hmm.
And that's got to be really tough.
I was, speaking of cartoons, I was watching some of the old Looney Tunes cartoons, and there's a famous one that's not, it doesn't have any of the popular characters. I Love to Sing-a, and it's a little owl.
Yeah.
I Love to Sing-a. And I was surprised when there was a caricature of Jack Benny on it. He was a bunny rabbit, Jack Bunny.
Well, not only is there a pun there, but as you probably know, the Benny radio show at that time was hugely popular.
Yeah.
So if you satired it in a cartoon, people got the reference instantly. They knew what you were talking about.
Do you know any other cartoon connections between the Jack Benny show and, you know, cartoons, theatrical cartoons especially?
Well, I suspect the most famous one was a later Warner Brothers cartoon back in the television era, which was the mouse that Jack built, which it was a Robert McKimson-directed cartoon of Warner Brothers where they basically took the Benny characters and turned them into mice.
Yeah.
And the cartoon ended with the Jack Mouse trying to save a few bucks by going into this restaurant, which was actually a cat's mouth, and the cat closes its mouth, and then suddenly there's a cut to the real Jack Benny sitting in an armchair, and he's dreaming this whole mouse Benny business.
Yeah.
and then he looks at the camera and remarks about what a dream it was, and then there's a cut again to the character, these little mice characters that come across, proving that it really wasn't a dream after all. And then Jack has his famous look at the camera to end the cartoon.
Yeah.
There are other ones, too. I mean, it wasn't just Warner Brothers. Other studios had a lot of show business caricatures. Disney did. MGM did. Columbia Pictures did as well. So there was a fair bit of, if you wanted to look around, there's a fair bit of Jack off and on in those days in the late 30s.
All right, let's go deep. Kenny Baker.
Or Dennis Day.
Or Larry Stevens. Or Dennis Day. I forgot about Larry Stevens, but he's in there too.
Well, poor Larry kind of... I don't know if I don't think it was a lack of talent on Larry's part. I think basically he knew he was just a fill-in, and they didn't really give him a lot to do other than sing.
Yeah.
I think he probably could have done comedy if they wanted to, but I don't think they wanted to go in that direction with him. I think Kenny Baker is a better singer than Dennis Day,
mm-hmm.
but I'm not much on Irish tenors to begin with.
Ah.
But as a comic foil, Dennis developed marvelously, especially after he came back from the war, where he was doing impressions, and he had a lot more comic chops. And of course, as you know, it resulted in him getting his own radio show, which ran on NBC for something like 7 or 8 years.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so what about Mrs. Day? She also did some cartoon voices.
Oh, indeed she did. More or less on the Flintstones, she was Mrs. Flintstone, where she was basically the exact same character.
Really?
As she was as Dennis's mother. So she'd go to Fred Flintstone going, "Ah, shut up." So there wasn't a lot of difference. Verna Felton had, I'm trying to figure out the exact phrasing, but oh, it's to Red Skelton when she was working on Skelton's show. I was acting before you were born, she said,
uh-huh.
because she originally started in legitimate theater when she was 8 years old.
Really?
And toured all over the Western states and into Western Canada. She had her own production company, in fact. She and her husband when she was in her 20s.
Wow.
Before she went back to Hollywood when radio broke in the 30s.
I don't think of her as a child star. You know, when I think of her, I always see the elephant from Dumbo.
I've seen old pictures of her in newspapers when she was 15, 16 years old, and you can kind of recognize her, but nobody thinks of her as anyone but an old battle axe.
Right. Oh, we haven't talked at all about Phil Harris.
Well, no, we haven't, and I think Phil was a great addition to the show. They finally figured out what to do with him. If you've listened to the broadcast after he came on and replaced Johnny Green in 1936,
yeah.
Phil was a very combative character. And they finally figured out that this really wasn't going to work. So they kind of modified him somewhat into being a stereotype of a musician where they're partying it up
yeah.
and hitting on the ladies and having a few drinks here and there and not being very competent in what they're doing. And that worked marvelously for him. And it seems that like he took that characterization, whether a lot of it was based on reality or not is open for debate. Yeah. But he took that characterization to his grave, really. I mean, that's the Phil Harris everybody thinks of up until the time he passed away. So you see him on old TV shows doing guest shots. He's doing that character that he did on The Benny Show in the late 30s.
Yeah, or even the Aristocats. It seems like they created that cat character that Phil Harris plays based on the Phil Harris persona.
Exactly. And it's the same in The Jungle Book, too. I mean, that's the Phil Harris character.
Yeah.
It certainly isn't anything that came out of Kipling.
Wow. Well, thank you so much for taking the time out and talking with us about the Jack Benny program.
No problem, John. Thanks for calling.
Our guest today has been Jim Benny. He's the author and collector of all kinds of vintage stuff at Trowfaz, the blog. You can find it at trowfaz.blogspot.com. That's T-R-A-L-F-A-Z. And if you're not yet subscribed to this podcast, go to iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts and look up This Day in Jack Benny. Or you can find the links at thisdaybenny.com.